Yeah, first of all, I want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I will try to manage in 15 minutes. I'm going to talk about the relation between covariant and canonical quantum gravity, and it's based on collaborative work with Thomas Thiemann, and we just put it on the archive this week, and you can find it under this number. So what is the motivation behind that? When we have on the canonical side, we very well know how the kinematical Hilbert space looks like. We have function based on spin network graphs that are like graphs colored by irreducible representations. And then we can evaluate, take the holonomies on the connection along these edges, and we get a functional. So in order to get a gauge invariant, we just have to insert intertwiners at the nodes. So for here, for example. So, and this is going to give us the state space of the origin of the canonical theory. And well, we also know how to implement the diffeomorphism constraint. And in principle, formally, we can also quantize the Hamiltonian. However, the solutions to the Hamiltonian are very complicated and only formally known, which is the main motivation for what I was doing, namely to search for a different or alternative approach to implement the Hamiltonian constraint. And while there is one, namely the original idea for spin foams, so if we time evolve such a spin network, we would get a too complex. So the edges go into faces colored by irreducible representations, and the nodes become edges of the two complex. So, and then we can some sort of associate a transition amplitude here named Z kappa, and then try to match it with the canonical theory. However, this is rather formal, this matching, so, and I want to explain it in a bit more detail what I actually want to do. So since you all know that the Hamiltonian is a constraint rather than a true Hamiltonian, then the time evolution of such a spin network would not yield a transition amplitude, but rather a delta function, some sort of that we want to implement the delta H here. So this is basically the heuristic idea going back to Reisenberger and Rovelli, and if in order to get the full delta function, we then have to sum over all possible ways, like in a Feynman approach, where those kappas, the two complexes are then our Feynman diagrams. So, and if we insert this into two states, we would get some sort of a scalar product or rigging map. So there have been many advances during the past years on those spin foam models, and the more recent models are the IPRL model or FK model, and the model going back to the Polish group, so the KKL model. And I will focus on the last one, so the KKL model, for several reasons. First of all, in order to construct our map here, we of course need some sort of a map between the Hilbert spaces associated to one graph gamma and the graph gamma prime of the canonical theory, where the Z kappa is some, where then the kappa has the gamma and gamma prime as boundary graphs. So now if you look at the original IPRL FK model, so I'm looking here at the Euclidean one, but what I'm saying on this slide is also true for the Lorentzian one, then this was built on simplicial triangulations. That means that the two complexes considered there are dual to the simplicial triangulations, which then only have four-valent boundary graphs. So the vertices in those graphs are always four-valent. But this is much too restrictive when we want to match it with the canonical theory. For example, if we use the Hamiltonian originally proposed by Thiemann, then it generates three-valent vertices. And, the whole game does not make fun if you just not allow three-valent vertices in it. So furthermore, there's a very tight relation between triangulation topology and geometry, which is not that obviously present in the canonical theory, because their geometry and topology are hidden in the set of all holonomies, and therefore we have to consider a much broader class of graphs. So then suppose we can just throw away the embedding information and throw away the simplicial triangulation, and we're just postulating abstract films. So these are basically two complexes made of a set of faces, edges, and vertices, and we can define the boundary graphs of such abstract films by saying this consisting of all edges and associated vertices to those edges, which are only contained in one phase. So, and here I also want to enforce a technical restriction, namely I want to still have control on those abstract forms. That's why I'm requiring that those abstract forms can be mapped to convex to complexes, so piecewise linear complexes. When we look at the APLKFK model, then we find that there's a Hilbert space induced on the boundary. So the boundary is this partial kappa here. So, but then the question is this Hilbert space related in a strict sense to the kinematical Hilbert space on the same graph? So, and as you well know, this both questions, so the generalization to abstract forms and, the proof that we can indeed identify the Hilbert spaces was given in the seminal work by Wojciech, Marcin, and Jurek. And it's now known as the KKL model, where I have to say that, in order to not get restriction on any spins, we just choose the Barbero-Emir-Cyri parameter to be an odd integer. So this is the don't worry, be happy choice. And because this problem that only appears in the Euclidean model, I'm not going to focus very much on this choice. So we are now almost there. So, because the problem is when we replace the two complexes here by abstract forms, we still want to have embedded graphs in the canonical theory, because otherwise we have problems to define, for example, the Hamiltonian constraint. And if we need to do a bit more work, namely find a better rigging map or a better scalar product, by defining abstract equivalence classes and then an identification of the embedded spin networks with abstract spin networks. Of course, by this procedure, we are going to wash out a lot of information. But nevertheless, if this whole procedure should work and we fix, for example, we wash out the moduli and the knotting classes of spin networks, but once we fix a knotting class, then the whole calculation should also work. So that's why we can also go to abstract graphs on the kinematical theory, and we can do this by defining a functional. Oh, there's a TS prime missing. So this is just with the weight at S prime here, which is defining our identification with the abstract equivalence class. So, and for simplicity, I just set this weight here equal to 1, and then it's basically just this average in here. Okay, so then we can associate an amplitude, as I said on my very first slide. So this amplitude decomposes of a phase amplitude, an edge amplitude, a vertex amplitude, well, and an identification with the data on the boundary network. And we have to sum over all colorings. So we don't only have to sum over all complexes, but also over all colorings. So this model, there are various versions of those models which are existing. It's not that much important here which one we are using. We could, for example, use the original KKL or the one proposed by Hugh, Mushin, and Carlo, or also the operator spin form model proposed lately. So, but it's more important we can choose, we can fine tune our amplitude such that our defined map has the following properties. First of all, it's cylindrical consistent in a sense for the canonical theory. And to each graph gamma, we can associate an identity mapping by this trivial complex as just a tube. So there's nothing happening inside, there's no internal vertex. But more importantly, what I will use is that we can define it such that we have a gluing property. That means if we have two foams, and two associated amplitudes together, and they share, they have a common boundary spin network, then we can glue them together and construct the amplitude by just considering the amplitude of the glued complex. And this is somehow equivalent to inserting a one here. So I have been writing down there. So now the idea is, why shouldn't we use this gluing property in the other way around and split complicated two complexes in order to get a better control over the full sum? Because this sum is hard, very hard to compute, or impossible to compute in principle. So, and I will show that this is indeed possible to split the complicated forms into simpler building blocks. But for this procedure, we need a unique. So this procedure should be better unique, in order that we can glue them together. Then again, And well, to make this procedure unique, we can introduce a classification of the vertices. Namely, we call internal vertices, which are directly connected to the initial boundary network by an internal edge here, as a vertex of first generation. So in this picture, it's V1 is a vertex of first generation, and V2 is a vertex of first generation. Okay. And well, and then we can proceed inductively, and well, here V3 would be a vertex of second generation. So if we only have a final graph, we could just count backwards, and if our two complex does not have a graph at all, or no boundary graph, then we just say all vertices of our first generation. So, and with this definition, with this classification, we can indeed prove that we can split any colored form, so consisting of a two complex kappa and the associated labelings of the faces and colorings of the faces and edges, in a unique way into smaller building blocks, which only contain vertices of first generations. That would mean we would split along the dotted lines here. And they can, and we obtain when the original form kappa had the highest generation was n, then we obtain exactly n building blocks. So now, how can we use that in the rigging map? So recall, this was our original proposal of the rigging map. So if we insert that, then we just obtain this one. So we're still summing over all kappas between the spin networks SF and SE, and we can then split it. So in order to further simplify this map, we can introduce a spin form tensor matrix. So this is the matrix set given here. So, and it consists by a sum over all one-time step forms that are forms which only contain vertices of first order, and then well, projectors between the kinematical Hilbert space and the subspace defined by the boundary graph gamma. And
they go from one generation to the next.
Sorry?
Which means they go from one generation to the next.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's gonna. Yeah. This is just for one step. Right. Well, and we have to sum over all graphs here, in principle. So and, since we sum over all one-time steps forms, it's very easy to show that this set is indeed a symmetric operator. And if we plug that into our rigging map, we see that this just gives a power series. Now, this is very nice because it's now we just have to compute the set in order to compute the rigging map. However, there are several issues with that. First of all, I've been ignoring most of the time that, well, we are summing over all two complexes and all colorings, so that means that it's very likely diverging because we have huge infinite sums. So we would need to introduce some sort of cutoff to make this set of one-time step forms finite and also a cutoff on the spins. However, this will still not help because, well, then maybe the single Z is not divergent. But when we take the power series or considering the power of n, then it might be still divergent. So we should also better introduce a weighting of those things in this way. And suppose we can introduce a weight such that it respects our gluing property, so that we can still glue. Then we could make sense of this expression here. So, however, if this is true, then there's a much bigger issue because this this power map does not do what we want to do. It's namely, it's not a projector because we can just it's some sort of a geometric series, and we could expand it like that. And if you multiply by the left or by the right with the Hamiltonian, we see that it's not going to annihilate the Hamiltonian. So, what is the reason for that, or what is going wrong? Well, option number zero, I called it because it's the simplest option, is that Z itself is a projector. So we don't have to take the sum. We don't have to take the full sub-power series, and then we should also not consider the zeroth order of Z. So and well, there was a similar approach. So more motivated by cross-graining in this holonomy spinform models by Bianca, Frank, and Wojciech. And they indeed found that this that one can define similar operators, which are indeed projectors, for example, for BF theory. And there's also this result I obtained together with Emanuele and Thomas Thiemann, that when you only consider the Euclidean Hamiltonian constraint and you're setting the Barbero-Emitzi parameter to 1, which reduces the spin foam amplitude to an SU2BF amplitude, then you can show that certain amplitudes indeed annihilate the Hamiltonian. So it's not completely stupid to assume option 0. However, when we really look from the heuristic standpoint and the canonical theory, it's not quite clear why we should not consider the full sum. So then, well, option 1 and 2 would be just like that something is going wrong in our model. So, for example, the assumption about the weight was wrong, or the vertex amplitude is too local in the sense that they allow us to split the complexes. So one would probably need to modify the model so that the gluing property is not true. But option 3 is much more interesting because maybe it is because we're not restricting to one Plebansky sector in the spin foam model. And I want to use the rest of the time I have to elaborate a little bit more on that. So when we expand the delta function of a constraint C here in this way and introduce some sort of a double scaling limit, so we introduce this integration from 0 to t and let t go to infinity, and then we expand it as a Riemannian sum, we would find something like that. And, well, you could see, well, those guys would then correspond to our Z operators, but you can see that they are not symmetric while our Z is symmetric. That means we are not summing over this unitary operators, but over the sum of those unitary operators. And, well, this could be related by the asymptotic analysis, and so it would be nice to see if one, for example, can avoid something like that by using this proper vertex as proper vertex amplitude as proposed by John. So okay, so that's my summary. So we have introduced the single time step form. That's from a purely technical point of view, it's very interesting because it's simple, it formalizes and simplifies the whole formalism, and one could also try to relate it to other suggestions how to simplify this formalism, also by the Polish group. Then it opens up the possibility to further elaborate on the regularization of the Z guy, and, well, related possibly to GFT approaches or coarse graining, and the last two reasons I have already said enough, so I would like to thank the audience for the attention.
A couple of questions, maybe? Simon?
Does this approach lead you to new insight on how to study the semi-classical limit of the theory? For instance, you're considering arbitrary forms.
Yes.
Not just triangulation. So the result on the rejection doesn't necessarily apply.
Yeah.
Do you have any insights from this type of approach? How would you?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I'm throwing away most of the interpretation of the spin foam model. I'm just using it as a tool. So I find it a bit difficult in this approach to say something about the semi-classical limit in spin foam models. So in order to it would be interesting to do. To compare it with the semi-classical analysis in a canonical picture and see what this would yield for these arbitrary forms. But I don't have any new insights on that. But, yeah.
Can you go back to the slide where you have a solution and possible solutions with the problem? Yeah.
This one?
Forward.
Okay.
Yeah, this one. So I mean, about the option 0, it seems to me it's probably is a projector. I mean, if you factorize amplitude using f, and then on the f there's f projector.
Yeah, but this is the problem. I mean, this is true for the spin foam point of view. You're inserting an edge protector there, which is somehow restricting your intertwiner space.
Yeah.
But if I'm really going back to this original idea that it should be implementing my Hamilton. I mean, what you're projecting on is not on the solution space of the Hamiltonian itself, but a priori, when you take the spin film model. And when you really go back to this this idea that those are the Feynman graphs of my theory, then why should I not sum over the Feynman? Why is one Feynman graph enough to encode the full dynamics? So.
Okay,
Well, I mean, this is exactly what is happening in BF theory. There, one is obviously enough because it's triangulation independent. But I don't see why this should be applied for the full theory. I mean, it would be nice, but I don't see a special reason for that.
Can I comment that it might hold if you take the refinement limit and have Z as kind of an effective?
Yeah.
Object which already takes either the
finite
limit or the sum over all zeros into count,
and then this might be correct. Yeah, that was a bit short with my remark on coarse graining. I mean, this possibly, like the set operator, is possibly already some sort of an effective action and coarse graining, and then it might be actually the case that it is a projector. But my point is that if you take the original heuristic idea, then this is not going to work.
Okay, let's thank Antonia again. Okay, so thanks, Valentin, for chairing the session. And I'd like to thank the organizers and also apologize to the audience because I'm going to be speaking about a subject that was not what I initially planned. In fact, I'm going to be talking about a paper that has been written in collaboration with Sylvain Carozza, Daniele Oriti, James Ryan, and Matteo Smerlac. That recently appeared, and despite the fact that maybe that a good part of the audience is co-authored the paper, it's actually a short paper and easy to present in 15 minutes. So what is it about? In the context of spin foams, group field theory has been designed to tell us what it means to sum over triangulations in a field theoretic language. In fact, spin foams arise as Feynman diagrams in these theories. On the other hand, they are higher dimensional generalization of matrix models, which, as you know, give a definition of the two-dimensional path integral of gravity as a scaling limit of matrix integrals. Just in the same way, group field theory may offer the possibility to define the continuum limit of spin foam models. It should be noted that this point of view loses a bit sight of another interesting feature of spin foam models as far as the continuum regime is concerned, namely the closeness to topological quantum field theories. But this point of view benefits from our experience of matrix models and the availability of standard statistical methods. So in this perspective of matrix models, a recent breakthrough has been the discovery of the 1/n expansion by Razvan Gouraud, where n is a cutoff of the field modes, and which shows that the partition function is dominated by a certain class of graphs called Mellonic graphs, having the topology of a sphere. So this 1/n expansion, this new tool has been intensely exploited for the simplified tensor models, as we've seen in various talks given in this conference.
In particular, it has been shown that at leading order, they possess a critical behavior leading to a polymeric continuum phase. And we are getting close to defining double scaling limits. Of course, from the point of view of spin foams, we need to import and extend these results to full-fledged Kufri theories. In fact, it is expected that a lot of the properties of tensor models are universal. But so the results of our paper is the one step in this direction, one small step. Well, let's say it's a normal step for the authors of the paper and a small step for the program. Yeah. Teeny step for mankind, whatever. So we've looked at Bulatov-Augury models, which describe BF theory, three-dimensional gravity, and are the basis for four-dimensional quantum gravity model. And we obtained two simple results. First, we have an explicit combinatorial formula for the Mellonic amplitudes in terms of a two-dimensional analog of the Zeeman-Zeek graph polynomials. You know, the Zeeman-Zeek polynomials show up in the parametric representation of the Feynman graph amplitudes in conventional quantum theory and provides a powerful computational tools for these amplitudes. And the first Zeeman-Zeek graph polynomial is known to count the number of spanning trees of the graphs. And we'll see that this two-dimensional analog counts the two-dimensional analog of spanning trees. And the take-away message is that to evaluate amplitudes, you need to count two trees in Mellonic graphs. A second result is that based on this formula, we found simple bounds on the amplitude and showed what was expected, namely the existence of a critical point. So it was indeed expected, and if people doubted it, this is the proof. So what is the context? The setting is that of colored Bulatov-Augury models, which mixes the original proposal of Augury and Bulatov and new ingredients introduced by Razvan Gural. So the dynamical variable is a collection of fields on D copies of a compact Lie group. Think of SU2 or SO4, with a shift invariance, gauge invariance. The dynamics is described by an interaction that has a simplicial combinatorial structure, mimic a D-simplex, and a trivial kinetic terms in the case of the topological Bulatov-Augury models, and kinetic terms which can be modified to construct quantum gravity models. And the partition function generates a class of graphs called colored graphs that have the structure of cellular complexes dual to triangulated pseudo-manifolds. So the amplitudes in the case of Bulatov-Augury model are well known to be plagued with divergences, and we will choose a heat kernel regularization by replacing the delta functions appearing in the propagator by heat kernels at small times. The Feynman expansion of free energy generates the following graph amplitudes. These are regularized version of the Bulatov-Augury amplitudes. You have a sum over group elements that are interpreted as discrete connections. And on each face of the graph, you have a heat kernel whose argument is the holonomy around this face. At small time, these amplitudes peak on flat discrete connections. The integrant has been obtained here by convoluting as many propagators as there are edges around the face, hence the appearance of the heat kernel with rescaled time, where MF is the number of edges on the face F. If we chose to regularize directly the spin foam amplitudes, right, replacing the delta function on the face by a heat kernel, of course, you wouldn't have this rescaled time. So formally, you could obtain regularized spin foam amplitudes by setting MF to 1. Okay, so now to take the limit tau goes to zero, what the 1 over expansion tells us is that upon an appropriate rescaling of the coupling constant, the free energy can be, the expansion of the free energy can be organized as a as an expansion in tau or the inverse of the cutoff. And the dominant contribution comes from so-called Mullonic graphs that are dual to triangulated spheres and correspond to crumpled triangulations of the sphere. And this is this dominant sector that I'm going to be looking at. And the first observation is that those amplitudes can be evaluated in terms of a Laplacian matrix of the graph. In fact, the second Laplacian matrix of the graph, which is expressed in terms of the second boundary map from face to edge in the graph. So if I go back to this expression of the amplitude, you see that at small time, so this amplitude peak on discrete flag connections, and on graphs that are simply connected, Mullonic graphs are simply connected. There is a unique flag connection, the modulo gauge transformation, using the small time asymptotics of the heat kernel, together with Laplace methods. Upon Gaussian integration, this determinant here, the face edge agency matrix here being the coinciding with this the face edge boundary map of the graph. So this is how you obtain this formula. And our first results is that just as the determinant of the first Laplacian matrix can be shown by the tree matrix, Kirchhoff tree matrix theorems to count the number of spanning trees of a graph. So it can be expanded in terms of the spanning tree of the graph. Here, the Mullonic amplitudes may be expressed as a weighted sum over spanning two trees, whose homological definition is here, and naturally generalize the notion of spanning tree. You see, a spanning tree of a graph is a graph containing all edges of the graph and do not contain any loop, and is connected. The higher dimensional version of this is this. So you have the triviality of the second homology group, and finiteness of the first homology group, saying that the Betti number is zero. Intuitively, T has enough faces to avoid holes, but not too many so that they do not form higher dimensional cycles. So the proof of this formula relies on the Cauchy-Binet formula, just like the standard tree matrix theorem and homological computations. Those combinatorial objects, those two trees, have attracted interest of recently attracted interest of combinatorists who have preliminary results in the counting trees in certain particular cases, and those results, of course, can be exploited in our case to obtain exact asymptotic evaluations of Mullonic amplitudes. It's worth looking at the three-dimensional case where the group theory describes a model of three-dimensional gravity. And in this case, you have two simplifying facts. First of all, you have a one-to-one correspondence between the spanning two trees of the graph and spanning trees of the dual triangulations. Second of all, in this case, the homological factor is trivial for two trees in three melons. And so the Mullonic amplitudes in three dimensions really reduce to the standard Kirchhoff polynomials as sum of the spanning trees of weights related here to the degree of the faces. We're hoping to use results and to study further the asymptotic enumerations of those higher dimensional trees to to calculate exactly the critical exponents, for example. But what we can easily do from that formula before getting there is to find simple bounds on the amplitudes and on the series, relating it to the, we can here make a link, bound the right bounds on the free energy of the Mellonic sector, which involves the free energy of the IID tensor models, which is known to be to possess a critical behavior, to have a finite radius of convergence. And so from these simple bounds, we can easily deduce our second result, that at leading order of the in the 1 over n expansion, the free energy of topological group field series actually possesses a critical behavior. And so the outlook is to, well, analyze the properties of these new graph polynomials. In particular, it's a graph polynomial expressed as a determinant, and we hope to generalize the deletion contraction relations of the Z-Menzig polynomials to these higher dimensional polynomials. And well, it suggests, it gives a new computational tool for GFT amplitudes, and suggests in particular that an interesting playground for a group field theory would be abelian group field theories, where a lot of the results here can be easily generalized. Obviously, this analysis should be extended to quantum gravity models, and we need to go beyond the Mellonic sector. Thanks a lot.
I have one.
Go ahead.
Do you have any idea of any relationship between the sum of the two trees you find and the value of the DF partition function on this field?
So
there is no
so the value
the combinatorial partition.
Right. So here in the Mellonic sectors, we're dealing only with spheres. And once BF theory is properly gauge fixed, the value is one. So right. So maybe an extension of your question is whether the heat kernel regularization breaks the topological invariants. And in fact, we already see here that this is the case. So I told you that formally. Spin foams regulated. You obtain regularized spin foam amplitudes by setting those numbers to one. What you're left with here in this formula is simply the number of spanning trees of the triangulation, which is non-topological. And it also hints that to recover a topological invariant from the regularized version of the GFT, you should rescale, at least for simply connected graphs, you should rescale the amplitude by this number of spanning trees. You should obtain the topological invariance.
And to follow up on this, and if that doesn't work, would you say that this regularization is then inconsistent with the symmetries of the theory, or what would be your take on that?
Well, it's actually simple to, if there is a manifestly a problem, because this sum over trees is the number of trees is non-topological. So
right.
But there is a simple way to cure the problem, as I said, to rescale by the number
of trees. Oh, I see. I understand.
Trees.
So that works.
Yeah. Okay. There is a way. There is a way to work. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Way to work.
Can I have a question? So I understand that you've shown an upper bound that the sum of the Mellonic graphs is bounded from above by the IID model.
Yes. Yes.
So this certainly shows that this function is analytic in a certain thing, but it does not necessarily show that it becomes critical. No, so it could happen that this function is actually analytic all over. I don't believe it, you know. I generally believe it becomes non-analytic at some point, but just an upper bound.
Well, you have an upper bound and a lower bound.
Have a lower bound also.
Yeah,
lower
sure.
Bound. Okay.
We have two bounds. So it's bounded by two series that have a finite
okay,
radius of convergence.
This is the lower bound. So
sure, right. So this series has a finite radius of convergence, so has a critical, possesses criticality.
So let's thank Aristide again.
So we now have Vincenzo from Marseille talking about now twisted geometry.
First, I would like to thank the organizers to give me this opportunity to present the present work with Simone Speciale. It's about the non-twisted geometry. That's first to the motivation. We all know that the loop gravity gives very clear discrete pictures of space-time, but it just seeing the space like hypersurface. From the canonical point of view, we can have that spin network states correspond to twisted geometry and with polyhedrons without the shape matching. And from the spin form point of view, and we know that at large J limits, we have from the simplicial spin form gravity, it can become the quantum ridge gravity, which means that the ridge action, in fact, can be reconstructed from the spin form amplitude. But how about the question is how about the non or light-like hypersurface boundary? Why we want to consider it? So it is important and interesting both in physics and the mathematics. First, from the physical point of view, we know that we cannot avoid to consider this kind of boundary because the non-hypersurface plays an important role in general relativity, especially in black hole physics. And the black hole horizon is actually the non-hypersurface. And also, another point is that it is well known that the initial data problem of general relativity on the non-hypersurface is simpler than the one with space-like case. Of course, it's in the sense that the initial data on the non-hypersurface is constraint-free. Then our question is how we use this in loop quantum gravity and use the non-formalism. And it's an open problem. And there are several problems that we have to deal with. The first one is that the quantum analysis, canonical analysis on the non-hypersurface is still missing. Recent years, the works by Michael Heisenberg defines the Poisson brackets on the non-inertial data based on the observables on non-inertial data. And so another problem for this formalism is that the time evolution from the non-inertial data is not exactly understood because we know that from space-like slicing, we can have a direct view of the from one slicing to another slicing. The evolution is quite clear, but from the non-slicing, it's not really clearly understood. So we are not going to really deal with all of this problem, but we just use the thing that we use the tools that which is the twistorial parameterization on the loop gravity to explore a possible and natural path to the direction of understanding the geometry of the non-hypersurface boundary. And our results in this work, there are three of them. The first one is that we found that the linear simplicity constraints with light-like normal is first of our first class. And the second one is that the reduced phase space from the twistorial phase space of loop gravity has a 2D geometrical interpretation. So the reduced phase space, in fact, describes the geometry on the 2D plane, which is the intersection of the two non-hypersurfaces. And the geometry can be described by a 2D pointwise conical structure. And then we can quantize the 2D surface, the reduced phase space, and give the kinematic Hilbert space. And in fact, the results are the U1 spin network. So let's go to the section one. The section one describes the constraints. And so we found that the constraints are simpler when the n is light-like. We all know that from BF theory to general relativity, the linear simplicity constraints is needed. And the linear simplex constraints is to make the bivector to be simple, and in the noun case, it's still valid. And for the closure constraints, is the discrete version of the Gauss law in loop gravity, and it is still valid for former closed tetrahedron because of the Minkowski's theorem. We can easily calculate the degrees of freedom of the non-tetrahedrons and find if we from the general bivector and to impose the closure constraints and the modulus non-rotations and one scaling on the non-directions, so we will get the same, exactly the same degrees of freedom. So in fact, this major properties of these two constraint zones when n is non is exactly the same as the space-like. But the formula is quite simpler because first, for the simplicity constraints with non-zero inverse parameter gamma, it becomes simpler. And here the P1 and P2 are the translation generators of the non-rotation that keeps n invariant. And all of them, the three of them, are the first class. And the second, we can define the Hodge dual of the bivector in this form. And n is the stabilizer, and A is the area, and the B is the non-vector, which defines in this way, and the closure constraints become in this form. And we can find if we contract it with n for the left-hand side and the right-hand side, we can get the area closure constraints, which is one of the closure constraints and plays an important role in our further discussion. So the most important thing is that we found that all of these constraints are first class. It makes things simpler, but it will be fine that the reduced phase space would vary more. And then we twistorial parameterize the holonomy flux phase space of loop gravity. It's already introduced by Simonis Bezzali and Wolfram Wieland, and the area matching condition is needed to get the T-style L2C. And in terms of spinners, the simplicity constraints reads in this form, and the F2 is a new one, which is also first class, you can see from this. And the delta OAA dot is the spinorial version of the of N. And in fact, the simplicity constraints can be packaged as the incidence relation in this form, but since the delta is not invertible, the solution actually contains the gauge degrees of freedom generated by F2. Then we already have the solution of the constraints. Then how we describe, how we interpret it, and I will discuss it now. First, we do the symplectic reduction. We just first consider one link of phase space, and the radius of symplectic potential is defined by the pullback of the embedding map. And C embeds one orbit of the simplicity constraint surface to twister space. And the symplectic potential of the twister space become just two complex numbers, that and that tilde. And if we also impose the area matching conditions and the modulus its orbits, then the symplectic potential actually just two variables, J and phi. J is defined by Z and Z bar, and phi is the angle between the sum of the angle of Z and Z tilde. And both of them are gauge invariants. And we can directly read the Poisson bracket from it. It's just in this shape. And okay, now we already have the variables, and then we give the geometrical interpretation of that. First, on the constraint surface, we can reconstruct the non-polyhedrons thanks to the Minkowski theorem. And second, we can find that, in fact, the reduced phase space is much smaller space since all of these constraints are first class. The geometry is encoding in the independent loop of the graph. And in fact, we can see that degrees of freedom is just depends on the number of the individual dual face or the loops. And then we can define the gauge. Because of this, we can define the gauge invariance based on the loops, which are defined, which is J, which is a mean value of the J's along the loops, and the phi is the one conjugate to J, and the Poisson bracket can directly read in this way. And we can see this if we have three links with J phi and impose the closure constraints on just one node because it's closed, then we can get the phase space variables in these four variables. And then we already have a very good variables to describe geometries, and it's three-dimensional or two-dimensional. And first, so we can see that from the flux, it's proportional to J sigma 3. Sigma 3 is the polymatrix, the z direction. On the reduced phase space implies that the bivector B is not only orthogonal to the N1, which is the stabilizer of the simplicity constraints, and also the parity of it. And it means that the reduced phase space is actually give a 2D plane, which is intersects of two non-hypersurface with normals are N1 and N2, respectively. But it can also view it like this. It can also be understood as that from the reduced phase space, the two intersecting non-hypersurface cannot really be distinguished. But if we use F1 and F2 to change the orbits of the constraint surface, we will recover the geometry of the non-polyhedron. So the reduced phase space is lying on this S, but if we acting of F1 and F2, it will recover the polyhedron interpretation in the non-hypersurface H1. And about this two plane, there is a geometrical interpretation of that. It's just a conical structure. From this, we can see that from the discrete version, we define for each loop a C and J, and it naturally form a cone from it. And C encodes the intrinsic curvature of the two plane because you parallel transform the M here vector to this one HM here, and the intrinsic curvature, in fact, is 2 pi minus xi. So xi f is the intrinsic curvature. There is also a nature pointwise symmetric equipped with the conical manifolds, which is this one, and that is the coordinates of this cone. Then we go to the quantization part. We can quantize it just using the Schrodinger representation and then define the Poisson brackets of the twistorial phase space and define simplicity constraints. Of course, we are using the ordering here. Different order might give different results. And also we give the area operator, which is this one. Classically, it's just as one half of the square of the norm of the B. Then we go to the kinematic Hilbert space and the spin network state. The Hilbert space we are using is HK rho, which is a homogeneous function realized a unitary irreducible representation of SL2C. And the basis on this space we are using is the ISO2 basis, which is the irreducible representation of the ISO2. And the basis is labeled by the Huygens value of P1 and P2, which defined in this way. And the state actually looks like this. And we impose the simplicity constraints strongly, and we finally get just one state for each Hilbert space K rho. And because here we find that the F2 simplicity constraints actually gives the eigenvalue to be zero. We can sum over all of this Hilbert space, then we can form actually a U1 unitary irreducible representations with eigenvalue 2k. So here in this space, we don't have the measure that's in this smaller Hilbert space, but in this larger Hilbert space, we can actually define a measure and to in this Hilbert space. So actually, it doesn't mean that's what we are considering is zero measure, but with a measure that's in this bigger space. And then we can solve the error matching condition for a certain graph and the closure constraints. And finally, after solve the closure constraints, we find that the Hilbert space is the gauge invariant one for each node, and the U1 in the winner is delta K0 in this case. And finally, you can find for certain graphs the Hilbert space in this form, and we can define spin networks in this way, and with the labeled KL and the products of all of these independent intertwiners and the sum of all independent k's. And as a function of spinners, spin network states is in this form. And so we can get the expectation value of the area square. It's very simple, just this one. Very simple things. And now comes the conclusion. In this work, we have three main results. We answered that the constraints is much, we found that the constraints are simpler and they are all first class. And in quantum level, we can impose them all very strongly. And the second one is that because the constraints are first class and the phase space is quite small or smaller than the usual space like one. And each link is only parameterized by two real gauge invariants, J and phi. And in quantum theory, the state ends up with just a U1 spin network state. And we also give a geometrical interpretation of the reduced phase space coincided with the double non-hypersurface formalism, which sometimes calls the 2 plus 2 decomposition. And the phase space corresponds to a 2D conical singular structure, which can be interpreted as the intersection of two non-hypersurfaces. And then comes to the open questions and so what we're going to do maybe next. The nature question is that can we give the dynamics with this formalism? We already tried a lot of things. And first we tried the Boost Hamiltonian and we find that if we only add the Boost Hamiltonian for one half link, it changes the peak angle CF and the cone peak angle of the cone and the J keep invariants. But it's a little bit strange because when we sum of all of this Boost Hamiltonian of all nodes in the same weight, and it seems that the reducer phase space actually invariant. So it seems that it doesn't really give some dynamics from this reduced phase space. And another thing is that from the spin form point of view, and we can find that the full simplex doesn't work if we only want the boundary to be null. And the full simplex can have at most of both non-tetrahedrons. So the thinking is that maybe we should consider a new kind of boundary which is not full simplex to adapt this kind of formulation that all of this boundary to be non-tetrahedrons or non-polyhedrons. And another further things that we can do, maybe we can looking for the applications on black holes. Can we calculate the entropies based on this formalism, or can we do something about the horizon dynamics? And the last thing might be to revisit the free initial data problem, because we are not quite sure that our reduced phase space is the same as the space that's discussed in the non-formalism. So probably we can kind of explore the canonical formulation of the non-hypersurface. So that's all. Thank you.
Yeah. So coming to this canonical formulation, so when you look at the horizon in the G framework, and you reduce your H symmetry as far as you can, which is up to U1, then your canonical variables would be probably this phi which you had there, which is the opening angle of the horizon. And conjugate to that would be an area density or water.
Probably. I'm not so sure because
no, I'm making a statement.
Yes.
Then, okay, so you have this intertwiner space where the simplicity constraints were imposed strongly. Did you calculate the dimension of that space?
Dimension of that space?
Yes.
The dimension is actually zero. So there is no degree of freedom.
So you're not worried that you get like zero entropy of this?
But we still have area, in fact. So it's different from the picture of the SU2 kind of way of calculating the entropy. So could be there are some, because you have the area expectation values and you can change that. And it's different from the point of view that you have the SU2 in Stoiners and you can change the shape of that to make the entropy. This one could different kind of view of that. Would be different, not because that's the intertwiner is zero volume, is 0 degrees freedom, then you cannot change the shape. It's not in this case. Maybe the spin networks just own this boundary, lying on the boundary, not a bunch, a lot of bunches point out from the horizon. It's maybe not different. It kind of the view could be different in both cases.
Just to add on, the intertwiner picture of the Lekor transform quantizing which enzymes on the boundary here, we're just looking at the bulk theory in principle, not at a isolated horizon quantization. If you want, the Lekor would be an application. For the moment, we're just taking a bulk. So I wouldn't jump into thinking that intertwiners would carry entropic information around the Lekor. It's not yet.
Okay, thank me, Jay, again.
Which one is the pointer? How can I change the thing? How can I change the thing?
Forward, backwards, pointer.
Okay. So, hello, everybody.
Okay, so we now have Ula Shiravi talking about the path interval spin forms.
Okay, our motivation is to ensure the equivalence between spin form models and canonical analysis. And in the current spin form models that are used, just the kinematical level of loop quantum gravity is used. And for full equivalence, the dynamics also have to be equivalent. But we want to have a step forward in relating this spin form model, which is a path integral approach, and this canonical analysis. And we use a method which is called reduced phase space method, which the reduced phase space means that the phase space that all the constraints are satisfied. So if you use a path integral in this reduced phase space, the inner product that gives us at the end is going to be the physical inner product. And it is believed that we have, we have to use this Liouville measure for this method. So the Liouville measure is this dp dq, which are the canonical variables on the reduced phase space instead of just the configuration variables. Because now we are doing the Hamiltonian analysis, so we have to use this Liouville measure, and also this Liouville measure preserves the phase space volume. And also for the action, we have to use this Hamiltonian form of the action. As we will see that this analysis and this equivalence with the canonical approach has some non-trivial effects for the path integral and, of course, eventually in the spin foam model. And the non-trivial effects appears for the measure factor. The measure factor is everything that appears here in the path integral. Like here in the path integral that I'm showing, the measure factor is 1. So we have just dp dq. But sometimes we can have a function of q or configuration variable here, which we call, we have non-trivial measure factors. And as we will see that this canonical analysis leads us to this non-trivial measure factors. And just say that this approach, this work is all in the continuum level, so it's still not discretized and it's not quantized. So, and the phase part of the path integral has been, of the spin foam, has been studied by many authors just to make sure that the phase part has a form of I to the action. That it leads to, that the, in the asymptotic, it means that in the asymptotic level, they have the correct classical, they give the correct classical limit. So this phase part was studied, but the measure factor was not, it didn't get that much attention, but it was calculated for the Plebansky-Holtz formulation recently in this paper, Engel, Hahn, Thiemann. And just to say that this reduced phase space approach can be applied to any formulation of gravity, but because our goal is at the end to use this in the spin foam model, and the spin foam model use the Plebansky-Holtz formulation and has the desired variable for the spin foam model. So we use this reduced phase space method in the Plebansky-Holtz formulation. But if you use it in other formulations, because we are using the reduced phase space, and in the reduced phase space all the constraints are satisfied, and all these formulations basically are describing the same theory. So at the end you should get the same answer. Okay, this approach has been studied in this paper, and but the, in that paper, the in the Plebansky-Holtz formulation, our canonical variables are a connection and a two-form Plebansky, call it Plebansky two-form. But in the spin foam, in the spin foam models, this X appears, and the, we are summing over spin and intertwiners that label the eigenstates of this two form, and the connection doesn't appear. And what we want to do, we want to start from the path integral that this that was derived in this paper, and to integrate out the connection. So then it's prepared for the to implement it and to be used in the spin foam models. And because this X is at the end, because when we integrate out the connection, so we are just left with the variable X. And that is related to tetrad, and that's gonna define the geometry. That's why we call this at the end purely geometric path integral. Okay, the outline of the talk is that I just give a brief review of the reduced, like just explained very briefly what this reduced phase space path integral approach is for a general Hamiltonian system with constraint, not just a general relativity, just a general framework. And then applying that to the Plebansky-Holtz formulation, the next step is to integrate out the connection. That's our main goal here. But to ensure the, all the factors are correct and like there was no mistake in the calculation, we also do the ADM path integral with the same method. And at the end, we compare the result that we get from ADM path integral and also the Plebonsky-Holtz formulation, and then we find that they match. Then the last slide is the conclusion. Okay, the starting point for this reduced phase space path integral is this, as I said in the first slide, is this path integral that we are using here we are using the Liouville measure, and the action is in the Hamiltonian form. And here the star means that this P and Q are, PQ and P star are the canonical variables on the reduced phase space. But usually this, because these are the variables on the reduced phase space, they are not easy to work with, and if you want to do calculation, it's better to go to the, use the canonical variables on the whole phase space. And if you want to just do the change of variables from the reduced phase space to the whole phase space, well, what we get is this long formula. And this is equivalent to that one. We are just changing that Q star, P star to PQ, which are the canonical variables on the whole phase space. But you will see here that some other factors appear. Here, S means the second class constraint, F showed by first class constraint, and here these are the gauge fixing functions. So you can see that the determinant of the Poisson bracket of second class constraint appear here, and this is called Fadiev-Popov term, the determinant of first class constraint with the gauge fixing conditions, and also, of course, we have to impose the constraint too. We are not doing gauge fixing in our calculation because because our goal at the end is that to apply this to spin foam and in spin foam, there is no clear understanding of gauge fixing, and not everybody likes to do gauge fixing. So we think that it's important to have this approach with not gauge fixed. And then at the end, if somebody likes to do gauge fixing, it's easy just to choose a gauge fixing function and then insert this Fadiev-Popov term and insert also this gauge fixing. I mean, imply this gauge fixing functions too. But we are not doing that in this work. And just say that this path integral that I wrote here, this is the partition function. If you want to calculate expectation values of operators, we use this integrand to find the expectation values, for example, of O here. But in our calculation, now this O doesn't affect, as long as the O or the function doesn't clearly depend on the variables that we are integrating out, which in this case is the connection. So if this is not dependent on the connection explicitly, we can just drop it. But then it's understood that the formula that we gain is the partition function. Okay, so that was for a general system with first class and second class constraint. And then in this paper, this is applied to Plebonsky-Holtz formulation, which has this BF action and the variables of these connections. And as I said, in this Plebonsky 2 form, we have the simplicity constraint that if this constraint is satisfied, we have four sectors for the x, and we are restricting our path integral to the sectors two plus and two minus. And I don't go to the detail, just the final result of that paper is this formula. And what is important to see here is that the four volume and the three dimensional volume appear here. V here is the determinant of G, which is a four-dimensional volume on shell, and three-dimensional volume, especially three-dimensional volume is important here because it breaks the manifest covariance. And here again, I just dropped the gauge fixing condition. But our goal, we want to integrate out the connection. And if we expand the action, we can see that the action is quadratic in the connection. So we have this Gaussian integral. I just suppress all the indices in this formula just for simplicity. I show the indices here. And if you just solve, like integrate out the connection, we get this factor as a measure. So this is A is the operator that appears here, multiplies by omega squared. And here we get it for the exponential. And by explicit calculation, this exponential is going to give us, again, the BF action. And
so
the
is Gaussian, but is it positive definite, or you made some analytic continuation to find this Gaussian integral?
Is it what?
Is it just real Gaussian integral completely positive definite, or you had to do some tricks like omega goes into I omega to...
It's just a
It's
just formal. It's just a formal. Gaussian.
Yeah. I just put like all the coefficients of omega squared in this operator A.
It's like the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And A is dependent on the X. A and B are dependent on the X. So I just thought that this makes it clear that it's like the Gaussian integral. And so because A and B are dependent on the X, so here when I take the determinant of the A, and the X is in terms of, and we are on the 2 plus and 2 minus section. So X is dependent on the E, the tetrad. So when I take the determinant, it gives some power of the volume, of the four-dimensional volume. And when I insert that into the integral here, I see that, again, the three-dimensional volume is here, just the four-dimensional volume appears with a different power. But, and that was the final our final result, but just to make sure that all the powers are correct, we start also from the ADM formulation. In the ADM formulation, these are our canonical variables. We don't have second-class constraint, we have first-class constraint, which is the Hamiltonian and 3D homomorphism constraint. So if we use it in this general formula, we don't have this term. And because we don't do gauge fixing, so we don't have this term too and this term. So that is our starting point for the ADM formulation. And the only thing is that for the first class constraint, which are H and HA, we just cast them in the integral form. So we don't have a delta of the constraint here. We just add them to the action and integrate over the Lagrange multipliers. And again, we don't have the Fadier-Popov term. Again, and we want to integrate out the momentum and here. And again, the action is Gaussian in terms of momentum. And these are explicitly A, B, and C, the operators that appear here. So we want when we integrate out the momentum, this is again Gaussian. We explicitly calculate this A, which gives us this. H here is the determinant of the three-dimensional metric, and N is the lapse. And the exponential gives us the ADM Lagrangian. So the final ADM path integral that we found is this. And now we want to compare these two formulas. But they are in different different variables. So what we should do is we just need to do the change of variables. And when we do change of variables, we have the determinant of the Jacobian here appearing in the measure factor here. Like if we do change of variables from the four-dimensional metric to this ADM variables, we get this determinant of the Jacobian. And every time we have to find this Jacobian matrix and then the determinant of that Jacobian matrix inserted here. Actually, that was just one sample of the change of variables. And actually, that was the simplest one, which we went from the ADM variables to the four-dimensional metric variables. And we have to do two more change of variables, which are here. And at the end, if we just insert that into the path integral, we see that the measure factors match. My conclusion, just the important thing to see in the result was that the appearance of this three-dimensional and four-dimensional volume, which was there even before we integrate out the connection, but now just with different powers, especially the three-dimensional volume that breaks the manifest general covariance. And we don't have the gauge fixing, as I said. We tried to do gauge fixing starting from the ADM path integral, but for a general gauge fixing function that was just dependent on the metric variable, not the momentum variable. And we got something ugly, which had some error function in it. But if we choose a specific gauge fixing function, it may be not that ugly. It may be something actually easier. But we are not convinced at the end that we have to do gauge fixing. But if you want to do it, it's just easy just to insert this factor into the integral. And the equivalence of the gauge fixed and non-gauge fixed path integral is still an open question in the case of gravity, because in the case of gravity, the structure functions appear, and the gauge group is not a Lie group. And there's an argument that if you have a Lie group, the equivalence of gauge fixed path integral and not gauge fixed path integral is obvious. But in this case, we cannot conclude anything. And this was the continuum path integral. The next step is to discretize and quantize this measure and import that to spin form model.
Questions? Simone?
So then, to integrate out the connection, do you need to assume the invertibility of the tetrad, or is it a
no? It's just very formal gas in it.
It doesn't require the tetrad thing.
When the determinant gets the volume, then
there would be
an integral that it generates.
Sorry.
There would be something to the minus one, inevitably. Because the thing one two gas in.
Let me look at the expression for these tensors again. I mean, obviously, if there's some inverse of the metric appearing in the covariance matrix, then yes, of course, you have to assume non-degeneracy. No, it doesn't. It doesn't require non-degeneracy because there's no inverse of the metric appearing.
If you don't have more additional questions, let's thank Dr. Zabian.
Can you hear me?
I think so, yeah.
Yes. Hi. I'm from the University of Pisa, and this is the work I did with Simone Speziale for my master thesis. I'm going to present you a study of the secondary constraint in a toy model for twisted geometries. Let me give you a clear statement. As we saw in many talks in this conference, for example, the Simone Speziale review, the plenary talk of Etera Livine, and the work of Wolfgang Bieland and Jeff Nibida, twisted geometries are nothing but a generalization of Dirac geometries. They arise basically from a smeared version of general relativity motivated by loop quantum gravity. The main question is, are these kinematical objects or they have an independent dynamics from the Reggio case? We decided to address some aspects. Indeed, Bianca Dietrich and Jimmy Ryan argued that is it possible that the dynamics naturally select the Reggio geometries from the twisted geometries? And if this intuition is correct in general, there should be some important consequence, for example, for the spin form formalism. In the first part, I will give you the twistorial structure of the loop gravity phase space, and then I will present you the toy model we use for the study of the secondary constraint. So, as of course any of you know, we can treat GR as using the extended Hamiltonian formalism, for example, starting from the Holst action. And the structure leads you to the SL2C variables, which are canonically conjugate, and they are the fluxes, the three-dimensional fluxes and connection. A crucial step towards the quantization is, of course, the discretization of the theory. The loop gravity prescription is you fix a graph, you take your continuum variable, and you smear this variable over the fixed graph. And the structure, the smeared phase space, the smeared variables, form an algebra, which is the Hollonomy flux algebra, and the phase space is a T star SL2C space on each link of the graph. Let me stress just one fact. What's the meaning of working with just a fixed graph, just a graph? Well, Carlo and Simone were able to show that it's nothing but a truncation of GR to a finite number of the degrees of freedom. So it makes perfectly sense. So twistor structure. Twistor is just a word. We actually use just a couple of spinners. They have a natural SL2C invariant simplicity structure. However, they carry a representation of the little Lorentz group, but the space of one twistor is not enough to carry the representation of a T star SL2C. So we have to double the variables, but now the space is too big. So you have to perform a simplectic reduction using this constraint, the area matching constraint, and you recover the phase space of the covariant loop gravity, and of course, the twistorial representation of the full Hollonomy flux algebra on T star SL2C. What is the picture suggested? You have the graph, you fix the graph for the smearing. On each link, you attach the space of two twistors, imposing the area matching constraint allows you to recover the phase space of the covariant loop gravity. If one brings in the Gauss constraint, you can use the geometrical interpretation of this object as a collection of polyhedra, locally flat, but with discontinuous metric. And through the simplicity constraint, of course, you recover the gauge invariant phase space of the loop gravity. The geometry that arises is quite different from the standard one, from the Reggio one. Indeed, if you try to understand how these, for example, two tetrahedra are glued together, they lack of the gluing condition. So actually, they are really twisted. If you try to compute, for example, edge lengths from different tetrahedra, they have different lengths. So let me summarize just what I said. We have the object defined are covariant twisted geometries that fully represent the phase space of a truncation of a covariant loop gravity. The geometry described by this object is very different from the Reggio geometries. It's a generalization of the Reggio geometries, and this is due to the fact that the metric is discontinuous through the triangle. Secondary constraints in twisted geometries. Why? Why we are doing this? At the continuum level, you have a clear structure. You start with your SL2C variables. You impose the constraint that impose the uniqueness of the metric and the fact that you're using simple bivectors. The request of this constraint to hold through the evolution gives you an equation, which is the torsionless equation, and provides you the embedding of the gauge invariant phase space into the covariant phase space, TSR-C2C. After the discrete, the structure is not so clear because you have a clear setup for the primary constraint. You impose simple twisters and a unique locally flat matrix, which means twisted geometries, the object I described. But the consistency conditions are not clear. It's an open question because we don't have, for example, the analog of the discrete. We don't have the discrete analog of the torsionless. Of the torsion is not clear if this condition will give you the embedding of the gauge invariant phase space T star SU2 into the covariant T star SL2C. Some details in the continuum, for example, the simplicity constraint allows you to recover GR, for example, from BF. This constraint, the simplicity constraint, are first class, so they Poisson commute with any other constraint. And your secondary constraint is the torsionless equation. In the discrete, the structure is very different because the simplicity constraint naturally split into two parts. The diagonal part, which is Lorentz invariant, and it is first class. And we have a non-Lorentz invariant part, which is second class because it doesn't commute with itself, with its conjugate. And this is basically due to the fact that the fluxes in the Olbermann flux algebra does not commute. What's the mechanism that we propose, what the dynamic should do? The secondary constraint imposing an Hamiltonian looking for a dynamic should also make the diagonal part of the simplicity constraint second class. So one can interpret the secondary constraint as a gauge fixing of the orbit of this constraint, which should be first class. So one should identify the orbit of the diagonal part of the simplicity constraint and understand how the dynamic give you a gauge fixing for this orbit. So, main question is, this twisted geometry have a consistent dynamics independent from the Regge case. Bianca Dietrich and Jimmy Ryan proposed the shape matching conditions as a secondary constraint, and the underlying idea was that the mismatch could encode the torsion degrees of freedom, and the dynamic would be of would give you the Regge geometries. However, they derive this constraint, discretizing the same constraint in the continuum. They don't derive it from the study of a discrete Hamiltonian. There is a counter argument from Marcel, which is that the torsionless equation it's about the connection, right? So in principle, it has nothing to do with the geometry of the spacetime. And indeed, they were able to show that the mismatch does not encode the torsion degrees of freedom, because it is possible to find a twisted torsionless connection for the twisted geometries. So it's a problem because these two suggestions goes into different way. Why it's so is it difficult to solve this problem? First of all, because we are addressing a dynamical problem, so the last word will be put on just by the right dynamics. And besides, if you try to do some dynamics on the discrete theory, of course you break the diffeomorphism invariance, and you don't have anymore an Hamiltonian constraint, but just what Bianca and Barr called pseudo constraints. The strategy we adopted is, even in the discrete, if the space is flat, you still have that the evolution is given by a constraint. So we decided to look for the secondary constraints in a toy model which imposed flatness. That's the model we propose. These are the ingredients. You have the area matching that reduced the space of two twister to the covariant phase space of loop gravity. Simplicity constraint imposing simple twister and the Gauss law that is for the gauge invariance, of course. And the toy part of this model is the Hamiltonian, which imposes flatness spacetime. Is the scalar constraint. We decided to look at the trace of the holonomy over a link to be equal to the trace of the identity, of course, guided by the standard expansion of the holonomy as the identity plus the curvature tensor. What's the standard guess about the secondary constraint? The secondary constraints are often overlooked in the sense that one hopes that impose the secondary constraint in some way which is consistent with the dynamic, with the evolution, allows you to this way of imposing primary constraint shouldn't give you any secondary constraint. The constraint equation should hold through the evolution. In our case, we find that interesting secondary constraint actually arise from the diagonal part of the simplicity constraint, because our algebra is a second class algebra, so some constraint may not be preserved under the evolution. And that's the strategy we used. We fix the graph for the Smeri, for example, the for simplex we choose. The for simplex has 10 independent triangular faces. On each face, there is a system of three equations which came from each link. You can solve the system of the secondary constraint interpreting this equation as a solution for the four-dimensional dihedral angle as a function of the three-dimensional and two-dimensional boundary data. The solution we found for the explicit solution of the constraint, for example, for the first dihedral angle, is this one, which is the well-studied reconstruction formula of the four-dimensional dihedral angle using the three-dimensional angle. And of course, each link in the for simplex, each link is in the boundary of three independent faces. So you will have three independent solutions for the same dihedral angle. And the request that this solution must be consistent with each other gives you the well-studied shape-matching condition studied by Dietrich and Speziale that reduce the twisted geometries to the regular geometries. So, summary. Again, as many other people pointed out, the twistorial formalism is very powerful. It's a very powerful formalism, especially for loop quantum gravity. The gauge invariant phase space is not the does not describe a regular geometries. They are twisted geometries because they describe a geometry which is piecewise flat but discontinuous. The question we asked was, is there a dynamic which is different from the regular one? And the answer for this toy model imposing flatness is that the dynamic naturally select the regular geometry through the imposition of the secondary constraint. And this is achieved studying the orbit of the simplicity constraint, which are the four-dimensional dihedral angle as a function of the spinors. And the solution of the secondary constraints naturally perform a gauge fixing of this orbit, which impose shape-matching conditions. So the dynamic is the regular type, is the you recover the regular geometries. Thank you.
Questions for Fabio, Bianca?
So would you, I mean, these are second class constraints.
The secondary constraints?
The shape matching are secondary constraints.
Yeah.
So would you hope that the dynamics imposes these second class constraints somehow automatically, or?
Yeah, they arise naturally from the consistency condition.
Yeah, but usually what I mean is that in quantization, usually you solve the second class constraints. then the back to matching. That was always our problem.
Yeah, you have to.
It's not very clear how the dynamic should solve the problem.
Yeah, but of course, the dynamic should solve the problem, but we know the solution of the. I mean, the solution is that you can use this expression for the dihedral angle independently from the frame that you use in the tetrahedral. Sorry?
I'm asking about the quantum theory.
Well, this all of this is just classical.
Yeah, what is the conclusion for the quantum theory?
Well, for example, in the spin form, first of all, this conclusion is for a toy model which is in flat space. If, and I'm saying if this would be true in general, the conclusion would be that one should expect that even in general for the spin form formalism, you should recover Regge dynamics at the quantum level. If this is true in general, this would be a strong indication that the dynamic should be just the Regge type dynamics. This is the conclusion I put from for the quantum theory. But of course,
whether the spin form should be restricted to only some of the Regge geometries.
I know,
from the spin.
But I cannot say it from this analysis. I cannot say it from this analysis. Of course, one could try to quantize the model.
Did you have a question, John?
Just on the last slide, you mentioned that you called the secondary constraint, so the shape matching condition the gauge fix, but it's not a gauge fix, is it?
You can interpret it as a gauge fix.
Using this gauge unfixing formalism?
Let me clarify the point.
Where is it?
When you try to do forget about the dynamics for a moment, okay? You have simplicity constraint. This part of the simplicity constraint is first class. Mm-hmm. So it has gauge orbits. When you impose the dynamics, the Hamiltonian makes this a second class constraint. So you can interpret the secondary constraint as a gauge fixing for these orbits.
Again, it's St. Fabio.